Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson and for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The world has many brilliant, passionate people, but they rarely seem to make the headlines. But in one corner of the web, they are fully celebrated. Go online and check out TED. TED stands for Technology, Entertainment, and Design, but it's so much more. Short talks by professors, scientists, artists, and inventors on whatever they're most excited about. This hour on Point, TED curator Chris Anderson on bringing big ideas to everyone. You can join the conversation. Are you ready to go online for big ideas, passion, wisdom? Are you already hooked? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me from New York City is Chris Anderson, curator of TED since 2001. TED hosts two annual conferences in California in the spring and in Edinburgh, Scotland in the summer. More than 900 TED Talks are available online and have been viewed more than 400 million times. You can link to them at our website, onpointradio.org. Chris Anderson, so great to have you with us.
Thank you, Jane.
So for our listeners who are not familiar with TED Talks, can you describe what they are?
It's quite a simple idea, really. We just ask people who are remarkable, it doesn't really matter what field they're from, but they're remarkable in some way. We ask them to try and share what it is they're passionate and why in a way that's accessible to a broader audience, and they have to do it in less than 18 minutes. And that time compression and finding the right people, that combination there often results in talks that are simply riveting. You have to listen to them the whole way through, and they kind of change your mind about the world.
So that 18-minute time limit, I find that so interesting. What is it about that that makes such a great talk?
Well, I mean, there are some tests that show human attention spans petering out at around 18 minutes, and so that's part of it. We, you know, originally at TED, the limit was about 15 minutes, and speakers interpreted that as maybe 20 minutes or longer. So 18 minutes was originally done just as a way of being precise and showing that we were serious about the clock. Mm-hmm. But it's turned out to be a time that works very well on the web. It's about the length of a coffee break. And so it's long enough to say something serious, but short enough still for a talk to go viral on the web.
What's the mission of TED?
We just describe it as ideas worth spreading. We want to nurture a better conversation out there in the world. And we're actually quite agnostic about what better might mean. We want to bring together people from a wide array of disciplines. We certainly don't want any, you know, bad science or people on there promoting a company or a cause or, you know, religion or some, you know, quack belief. But beyond that, we want people talking about anything. We want provocation. We want insight, ingenuity, and we're willing to trust the power of interested, open-minded, smart people to take that conversation to the right place.
How many people are watching TED Talks every day?
So about 500,000 people watch one or two talks. So there's about 700,000 talks a day being viewed now. And they come from all over the world. It's probably 40% the U.S., but the rest is really widely distributed. The talks are translated into more than 70 languages at this point.
Let me play a bit of one of my favorite TED Talks, actually. This is Sir Ken Robinson. He's author of The Element, How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything. He spoke at a February 2006 TED conference about asking choreographer Gillian Lynn how she became a dancer. She told him that when she was 8 years old, she'd been such a poor student that her mother took her to see a specialist. And with Gillian in the room, the mother and the specialist spoke about Gillian's disruptiveness. Then the specialist took the mother out of the room and turned on the radio.
The minute they left the room, she said she was on her feet, moving to the music. And they watched for a few minutes, and he turned to her mother and he said, "You know, Mrs. Lynn, Gillian isn't sick, she's a dancer. Take her to a dance school." I said, "What happened?" I said, "She did. I can't tell you, sir, how wonderful it was. We walked in this room, and it was full of people like me. People who couldn't sit still. People who had to move to think. who had to move to think. They did ballet, they did tap, they did jazz, they did modern, they did contemporary. She was eventually auditioned for the Royal Ballet School. She became a soloist. She had a wonderful career at the Royal Ballet. She eventually graduated from the Royal Ballet School, found her own company, the Gillian Dance Company, met Andrew Lloyd Webber. She's been responsible for some of the most successful musical theatre productions in history. She's given pleasure to millions, and she's a multimillionaire. Somebody else might have put her on medication and told her to calm down.
This is a brilliant speech. It's actually the one that turned me on to TED Talks more than a year ago. I know it's been viewed more than 2 million times, something like that, Chris, right? I mean,
no, it's actually, it's really interesting. It's actually been viewed now more than 8 million times.
Oh my goodness.
And the numbers just go up. It's that talk has become a clarion call for educational reform. It turns out there are just millions of people around the world who respond to the notion that schools aren't doing the best job of fostering creativity. And this talk has gone viral in a big way, and the numbers just go up. I just looked at them, and just last month it was viewed 350,000 times, you know, despite being 5 years old at this point.
Speakers solicit you, Chris? I mean, and do you ever coach speakers about how to connect with a TED audience?
They certainly solicit. We probably get several thousand applications to talk or recommendations from various people. Yes, we do. In recent years, we are doing not necessarily coaching someone like Ken Robinson. He should be coaching us. But,
yes, exactly.
But we offer speakers the chance to rehearse. And as these talks have taken off on the web, the stakes have got higher for some speakers. So they've started to spend many weeks, sometimes many months, preparing for their talk, which means that into that 18 minutes is crammed weeks and weeks of effort.
What sorts of topics do people find on the TED website? Just give us the variety. I mean, I know what they are, but just give our audience, help us understand what's out there.
Well, of course, the notion is that all knowledge is connected, so we're open to anything on there. So there's talks about the brain, neuroscience, psychology, all those kinds of issues which people seem to find really fascinating, science more generally, biology, evolution, invention, technology, and then coming over into the business world, global issues like you know, poverty, global health. And then there's a whole aesthetic side of, you know, designers, artists, musicians, and performers, comedians, jugglers. I mean, there's this space for everyone. And what I think one of the hidden secrets of TED is that by mixing in some of the aesthetic stuff, you give your brain permission to absorb the ideas in a more profound way. When someone has been inspired or opened up by a piece of music or a piece of beautiful art, they actually get more excited about, you know, thinking about the world's future as well. And so it's in that mix somehow, this sense of possibility that excites people arises.
From mirror neurons to water purifiers, here's one about ants. Here's a TED Talk about ants. Stanford professor Deborah Gordon spoke in February 2003 about ants and how they divide tasks among themselves.
How is it that an ant can tell, for example, I'm a forager. I expect to meet another forager every so often. But if instead I start to meet a higher number of nest maintenance workers, I'm less likely to forage. So it has to know the difference between a forager and a nest maintenance worker. And we've learned that in this species, and I suspect in others as well, these hydrocarbons, this layer of grease on the outside of ants, is different as ants perform different tasks. And we've done experiments that show that that's because the longer an ant stays outside, the more these simple hydrocarbons on its surface change. And so they come to smell different by doing different tasks.
Chris Anderson, this is a brilliant speech. I mean, I am not at all interested in ants generally, but I was mesmerized by her, as I know you were as well.
So what's remarkable about that talk is that you discovered during the course of the talk that ant colonies behave in ways that are really remarkable and fascinating and very different from the behavior of the individual ants. And it becomes a metaphor for understanding a bunch of other emergent behaviors, including our own brains. There's a direct parallel there between how you have all these neurons firing in the brain in these intricate ways, and that they, you know, they lead to our conscious experience. how that happens is a mystery, but the way that Deborah Gordon there spoke about ant colonies gives you a sort of an aha moment of, oh, I never thought of my brain that way. Maybe I should.
What have you learned about the ability to communicate through TED Talks?
I've learned that I'm not nearly as good at it as a lot of the people who come to the stage. It's an incredibly rich and elaborate and mysterious thing. And it goes way back to our evolutionary roots. You know, I think a big part of who we are was almost shaped around those ancient campfires where people had their eyes locked on a speaker in a theatrical environment, the flames crackling, and watching every move on that face and picking up so many unconscious cues in addition to the words that got them excited or emotionally engaged or want to believe or want to resist that speaker. And it's actually a process that we only know just the merest tip of. But it's powerful. And that kind of human-to-human communication is probably richer than simply reading words. And so one of the thrilling things about being on the web now is that that type of communication can spread across the world. Any kid who's ambitious, who wants to learn something, can sit face-to-face with one of the world's great teachers and study that face and quite possibly be inspired by that person in an unbelievable way. How it happens, you know, I don't know. I know that some of the elements are, you know, humor plays a big part. It's disarming. Vulnerability, being willing to share emotion. There's a whole array of things there, and they add up to this magical package of electric communication.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're speaking with Chris Anderson, curator of TED since 2001. TED hosts two annual conferences in California in the spring and Edinburgh, Scotland in the summer. More than 900 TED Talks are available online and have been viewed more than 400 million times. Here's one from Bill Gates. He spoke at a TED conference in February 2009 about tackling malaria, and the audience was in for a surprise.
Now, malaria's, of course, transmitted by mosquitoes. I brought some here so you could experience this. We'll let those roam around the auditorium a little bit. There. There's no reason only poor people should have the experience.
Chris Anderson, Bill Gates, of course, very well known, but most TED presenters are not, are they?
No, that's correct. And certainly some of the best surprises are from relatively unknown people.
TED began as a conference. Will you tell us the genesis of TED Talks?
So, yes, originally it was an in-person conference. 800 people showed up once a year in California. That's how it was when I went there for the first time in 98. I fell in love with it. The sense of excitement and inspiration really came through by being exposed to all these different thinkers. And I was able to acquire it over the next 3 years and put it into a non-profit with the notion that, you know, that there was a possibility of a bigger life for the content there. And so over the last 10 years, we've been trying to figure out ways of letting it out to the world. You know, Bill Gates mentioned in that talk that it referred to the rich audience. Our view of TED has always been that these ideas should be for everyone. And so, you know, I pulled an amazing team of people together. And 5 years ago, we started putting the talks up for free on the web. And kind of to our astonishment, they took off like a rocket and found this global audience out there and managed to do so without destroying the conference itself.
Well, that's the key piece, right? People thought you were crazy for putting those talks online because the fee to attend the talk was quite high, $6,000, right, to come to the TED conference.
That's right. And so there was at the time some risk, but it's a really interesting thing. As the world gets more interconnected, the rules about what you should hold tight as an organization and what you should let go, I think, are changing. You certainly risk giving away, you know, intellectual property, but what you gain in a connected world is the possibility of building a global reputation very quickly. And sure enough, you know, within a couple of years, suddenly millions of people around the world knew about TED, and a lot of them actually wanted to come to the conference. So the demand for a conference passes actually went up, not down.
People call it their brain spa. I read that in one article.
That's right, brain spa. you know, you need to exercise the body as well. But yeah, for four days a year, people come away and just really try and zap every part of the brain, not just the thinking part, but the experiencing part, the aesthetic part. Yes.
Here's a call from one of our listeners in Salt Lake City, Utah. Mike, you're on the line. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just had a comment, and then as I waited, a question. That my comment would be, I find the people that I have a conversation about TED Talks really catch me off guard of the followers or the audience, that they're not, you know, stereotypical, an engineer says TED Talks. It's more coworkers or people who I wouldn't think would follow the site. And I find that conversation interesting, and I was just curious on what is the audience? What's your demographic? Is it young people or old people or college students? I'll take my comments off the air.
Yeah, it's really widespread, actually. It's all ages and both sexes and, you know, global in reach. This is actually an exciting surprise to us that especially the 20-something audience has been growing really, really fast. Hey, it turns out that lots of people out there are interested and excited by ideas and by the kind of the mental click that happens when your worldview kind of suddenly readjusts. It's just a really beautiful feeling to be given a new mental lens and go, oh, that actually really makes sense. That's exciting. And you can be a waitress or a taxi driver or a college professor to have that moment. And it's been really exciting for us to see people from everywhere get engaged.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Let's dip back into the TED Talks. Chris, you suggested we air something from Brené Brown's talk on the power of vulnerability. She's a professor of research at the University of Houston. She spoke about the power of vulnerability at a TED conference in 2000 and about how difficult it was to let herself become vulnerable.
You know how there are people that, like, when they realize that vulnerability and tenderness are important, that they kind of surrender and walk into it? A, that's not me, and B, I don't even hang out with people like that. For me, it was a year-long street fight. It was a slugfest. Vulnerability pushed, I pushed back. I lost the fight, but probably won my life back.
What do you like about that talk, Chris?
She, in fact, a couple of things. First of all, she actually gave that talk just last year. And she gave it at a TEDx event, which is one of the many hundreds now of self-organized events that are being held around the world. So it was very exciting seeing a really great talk come through one of those events. And there's actually many dozens of them now on the site because she was a speaker who we never booked. This was booked locally. And she is wonderful. She's been seen more than a million times now. And you know, her message about vulnerability and that far from it being a weakness, it's actually a strength. If you embrace it in the right way, it will make you stronger. I think that's such a powerful and courageous message that a lot of people totally responded to. Mm. And it was beautiful to see that talk emerge out of nowhere and create this, you know, wide impact.
Let's take another call from Say, who's in North Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Say. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course. Go ahead.
Well, a few years ago, I stumbled upon TED. A friend of mine from Chicago called and told me about this website. And I went on to watch this guy from Ghana, West Africa, called Patrick Awar. And since then, my life has changed. I'm on TED, and I follow the education series. I follow guys like Charles Lee Beter. I follow Sugata Mashra and even Sir Ken Robinson. And that speech has encouraged me to really, you know, look beyond myself and to take some introspection and self-flagellation and get out of my butt and get up and do something. So just a few months ago, I was able to, you know, take some of my own personal finances and start some, you know, endeavor in West Africa, Liberia, where I'm from, to help the poor. And I just want to tell Chris thanks for that. And thank you ever so much for the show. We really appreciate it. Thank you.
Wow.
What well, I say, you just made my day.
Well, but it happens all the time. I know it does.
It's really interesting that when people ask what is the impact of ideas, one of the biggest impacts seems to be that it increases people's sense of personal potential, that by being inspired by, I mean, although these speakers all have that from completely different areas. What they seem to share is this belief that your own actions can actually impact the world in some way. People get inspired by that, their own sense of possibility rises, and it's just so thrilling to hear. I mean, there are lots of stories like that, but hearing that live on the radio, that was really beautiful.
Here's another TED Talk. Neuroscientist V.S. Ramachandran is author of The Telltale Brain, A Neuroscientist's Quest for What Makes Us Human. He examined the role of a special type of neuron in human evolution at a TED conference. He describes mirroneurons, which fire not only when an individual performs a specific action, but when an individual observes that action as well. Humans have these mirror neurons, but animals, like polar bears, for example, do not. Here he is.
A polar bear to evolve a coat will take thousands of generations, maybe 100,000 years. A human being, a child, can just watch its parent kill another polar bear and skin it and put the skin on its body, fur on the body, and learn it in one step. What the polar bear took 100,000 years to learn, it can learn in 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes, right? And then once it's learned this, it spreads in geometric proportion across a population. And this is the basis of this imitation of complex skills is what we call culture and is the basis of civilization.
Hmm. Chris Anderson, it seems with these TED Talks that you're creating online a different kind of celebrity by promoting interest in people who communicate actual ideas of substance. I mean, I get on there and I can't stop. I go from one to the next. I must admit I'm an addict. But tell me, is this your passion? Is this the motive? Creating a kind of celebrity culture that is actually meaningful and substantive.
That's certainly one motive. It's wonderful that we're at a time when someone who's just a great teacher can have their words and influence ripple across the world at the speed of light. That hasn't always happened, and so. I think it's really important that there are platforms out there for these people. And yes, it's. I think there's a lot of people out there who are just so frustrated with mainstream culture and gossip and the nothing of substance right. consequence of so much of what we talk about. And it's actually thrilling to see some of these amazing teachers becoming a form of global rock star. We absolutely love seeing it.
Here's another TED Talk. Daniel Pink, who writes about changing the workplace at a TED Talk, he describes how to motivate employees and how big bonuses can actually stop people from performing well at all, but even the most simple of tasks.
There is a mismatch between what science knows and what business does. And what's alarming here is that our business operating system, think of the set of assumptions and protocols beneath our businesses, how we motivate people, how we apply our human resources. It's built entirely around these extrinsic motivators, around carrots and sticks. That's actually fine for many kinds of 20th century tasks. But for 21st century tasks, that mechanistic reward and punishment approach doesn't work, often doesn't work, and often does harm.
Do you have a favorite TED Talk, Chris Anderson? it's like choosing a child, I know, right?
Yeah, many, many, many favorites. Well, I don't know. I mean, one recent one that I absolutely loved was Eric Whitaker's virtual choir, where, he described a project in which people had come together across the web and each recorded their own rendition of one of his pieces of music, and he combined them into this performance that is so moving, and you can't watch that talk without A, shedding a tear, B, feeling better about the web and about the world.
We actually have it. I didn't know that was your favorite. Here's Eric Whitaker from a TED Talk in March.
I had this idea, if I could get 50 people to all do this same thing, sing their part, soprano, alto, tenor, and bass, wherever they were in the world, post their videos to YouTube, we could cut it all together and create a virtual choir. So I wrote on my blog, OMG, OMG, I actually wrote OMG, hopefully for the last time in public ever. And I sent out this call to singers, and I made free the download of the music to a piece that I'd written in the year 2000 called Lux Aurumque, which means light and gold. And lo and behold, people started uploading their videos.
Thank you.
That choir is made up of, I think, 185 people from 12 countries, and the image of that, I watched it as well, the patchwork of pictures of people moving across the screen as he is conducting them, it is amazing.
Indeed.
Let's take another call from Suzanne in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Suzanne. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. I just have to say thank you to Ted, because I have just been absolutely astounded. I spend so much time when I click on one. These are not just ideas. These are accomplishments. These are things people have accomplished all over the world that make contributions, and I am always astounded. There are not enough adjectives that I can think of to praise Ted's contribution to spreading this information. The other thing that I wanted to say is I just love the fact that I get five or six choices, and when I click on one, five or six more choices pop up that allow me to pursue further talks. And it just leads me to very unexpected places, and I'm so grateful that feature is there as well. It takes me back to the old days of the Internet when I used to, you know, be led further and further and further beyond, you know, what I started to do a search for.
Suzanne, thank you so much. I'm glad that you called. Chris.
Yes, thank you. And that's something which we're trying to get smarter at, is how to take people on a journey that's right for them. That now that there are 900 talks, it's actually quite hard to find the right ones for you. And so we're thinking hard about how to make that even easier for people. But right now you could certainly, you know, you can type in a tag word of a subject of interest and find talks related to that. But we'd like to do more.
Here's Mike in Marblehead, Massachusetts. Hi, Mike. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Hi, how are you, Chris?
Hello.
Hi,
welcome.
Mike.
I'm a school counselor in Marblehead at a middle school here, mm-hmm. and I just wanted to let you know that we use TED Talks fairly regularly to educate our students in different areas. We used one of several months back. There was a biologist out of Stanford, perhaps, who had put together a robot based on the biology of a gecko and how it walks up an incline. And so we were teaching the kids about how interdisciplinary learning can be. And I also used several others, Jamie Oliver's talk on nutrition, when I was doing units on nutrition and eating habits with our fifth graders. So I wanted to let you know that it's having an impact, you know, to adults such as myself and to young people, and it's such an effective teaching tool. So thank you very much for that.
Hey, it's great to hear that. And one of the things we're working on right now is to build a new archive of videos, even better designed, if you like, for use in schools. A little shorter than the 18 minutes, maybe is typically around 6 minutes, and each devoted to just doing something that creates a spark of curiosity, of excitement, that makes learning wonderful, as it should be. But thank you for what you're doing there, Mike.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're speaking this hour with Chris Anderson, curator of TED since 2001. TED hosts two annual conferences in California in the spring and in Edinburgh, Scotland in the summer. More than 900 TED Talks are available online and have been viewed more than 400 million times. Chris, tell me about the TED Prize.
So one of the questions people ask is, how does an idea actually make an impact on the world? And the TED Prize was an attempt to get one specific answer to that question. It's a prize that looks forward rather than back. We pick someone who we think is capable of inspiring millions of people around the world. And we tell them this: you've won $100,000, but more than that, you've won the chance to make one wish. No restrictions. Think big, be creative, and we, the TED community, will do all we can to try and make your wish come true. So that's the prize, and it's led to a series of really unusual and wonderful collaborative projects, often involving many thousands of people around the world working together, and trying to realize someone's vision. Mm. So, for example, Sylvia Earle a couple of years ago made this wish for a network of marine protected areas because she's so worried about the state of our oceans. And it led to an array of different initiatives. It led to about, in the end, about $40 million being raised and committed, and serious efforts to create new marine protected areas, to promote education for kids about the oceans, and so forth. And
we actually have her.
There's a new one every year.
Yeah. We have Sylvia Earle talking about that. She was awarded the TED Prize in 2009. Here she is.
With every drop of water you drink, every breath you take, you're connected to the sea, no matter where on Earth you live. Most of the oxygen in the atmosphere is generated by the sea. Over time, most of the planet's organic carbon has been absorbed and stored there, mostly by microbes. The ocean drives climate and weather, stabilizes temperature, shapes Earth's chemistry. Water from the sea forms clouds that return to the land and the sea as rain, sleet, and snow, and provides home for about 97% of life in the world, maybe in the universe. No water, no life.
What an extraordinary opportunity for her to take that TED money and to really make a difference.
And it's really not so much the prize money. I mean, that's just a small piece of it. I mean, she is so inspiring. She ended that talk. The whole room erupted. And afterwards, you know, just one tester, for example, came down waving a commitment for $1 million to support her. And it led to a big ocean to the Galapagos that brought in a bunch more resources. She's just a remarkable person, and is just a wonderful example of the kind of person who is a worthy prize recipient, who can really ignite interest and passion for a cause among a much bigger audience.
Here's a call from Newport, Rhode Island. Richard is on the line. Hi, Richard. Welcome to On Point.
Nice to be here.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Well,
hello,
Chris,
Richard. This is wonderful.
This is a rare
lovely surprise, Richard.
To talk to Chris Anderson. This is Richard Solwerman, Chris.
And you are, sir?
Although I haven't had the opportunity in the last few years to get to the conference, I just want to tell you that I am amazed at what a wonderful, an extraordinary and far-reaching job you've done with my baby. As some people know, I founded it in 1984 and ran the last one in 2002, and Chris has taken it to places I couldn't even dream of, and it's become an astonishing platform in the world, and I thank you for preserving it and making it bigger and better.
Oh. What was your original idea for TED, Richard, back in 1984 when you created it?
I observed a convergence of three businesses: the technology business, the entertainment industry, and the design professions. Uh-huh. And it seemed that nobody had observed that the good projects that were being done in the world were the convergence of these three disciplines. And so I did a conference. First year, lost money, and then it took off, and people... Now it's an old idea. It's not a very new idea that these things converge, but that's not the kernel of the idea of TED anymore. The kernel of the idea of TED is all these phone calls you've had and TED Talks and the TEDxes and all the other things that Chris has done with it. Mm-hmm. So the original idea has been not lost, but and is still to be found in threads through it, but it's much bigger, much better, and much more far-reaching than mm-hmm.
Chris Anderson.
Well, Richard, it's wonderful to hear you, and I know that there are millions of people around the world who are incredibly grateful to you for the spark, the piece of genius that led to TED coming into being, and the format that you helped build. And you know, it really was a unique thing. It certainly changed my life, you know, the ripple effects of it, Richard, going. Will go on for a very long time. So it's amazing that you called in. It's so good to hear you.
Well, come up and see me in Rhode Island sometime.
Richard, thank you very much.
All right, we'll make that a
day. Thank you very much. Chris, tell me more about the TEDx experience. You mentioned it earlier in the program, but how many volunteers are actually setting up TED conferences? These are sort of the babies of TED Talks, aren't they?
That's right. So the germination of this was a couple years ago when we were starting to get deluged with requests from people to bring TED to their city or country. And, you know, we couldn't do it. And we'd had this experience with the talks and also with translations, where if you let go of it, just let the stuff go. For example, with translations, we let other people, volunteers, do the translations and check on each other, and it led to these amazing professional quality translations of hundreds of talks in dozens of languages that we could never have done. So we thought, well, what if we let people organize their own TED event? Could we actually give them our brand? Is that too risky? Most people, again, probably thought it was too risky, but we came up with this slight variant on the brand called TEDx, where the X stands for self-organized. But the logo otherwise looks just like TED. And we said, okay, you can apply for a free license. If you want to do a TED, just apply for a free license. And so long as you follow our format and a few simple rules and you don't use it to make money or promote some agenda of your own, mm-hmm. It's yours. And to our astonishment, instead of, you know, a dozen or two of these things happening, hundreds and hundreds happened. We're currently getting license requests at the rate of about 20 a day. Mm-hmm. And this year there will be more than 1,000 of these events. So that's several every day are being held.
And how many volunteers? In the world. How many volunteers?
So there's about as the main organizers, there's something like 2,000 of them now. But several of them, they're all working with bigger teams, and so there's many thousands of volunteers around the world devoting often months of effort to do this. And the level of ambition of these events is astonishing to us. I mean, people are booking full-on theaters, selling out audiences of 500, 1,000 or more.
I actually read about one in India, where a TEDx event in India, yes, where 5,000 people showed up.
That's right, at a Muslim village in northern India. Yes, an amazing story. This woman who fought her village elders for the right to do it, did it and brought in this huge crowd of people. Those are some of the most thrilling ones. In Kibera, Africa's biggest slum, there's a group, Chris, Kevin, Dixon, who have put together just a TEDx event in a little tiny old battered church, you know, the corrugated tin roof, and they hang a sheet on the wall. But that people come from the slum and they talk about a better future. Mm. And it turns out the place is teeming with innovation. Mm. It turns out that a lot of it is exactly the same kind of conversation that we have in California. And it is so thrilling to imagine a world where young people, it's typically is people in their 20s and 30s, but they're excited by this. They want to believe that in a connected world, they can connect with each other, they can learn from each other, they can make a better lives for themselves. Mm-hmm. Makes me very excited.
It is amazing. Bonnie is calling now from Williamsburg, Virginia. Hi, Bonnie. Glad you waited.
Hi.
Thanks. Go ahead.
I've been thinking about putting on a TEDx conference since January, so I'm so happy to talk with you, Chris, today, and I'm so happy about this program, Jane. Thank you for doing this. How do you put one on locally without dealing with, I guess, people's political agendas and self-aggrandizement that they would want to be on a panel and go on and on and on beyond 18 minutes. You know, how do you select the right folks?
Bonnie, thank you. Chris.
Well, it's not always easy. You have to be a little bit fierce at times. You have to be very clear. I mean, the good thing about the TEDx rules is that you have to stick to those rules, so you can't bring in a speaker unless they're committed to doing a short, well-prepared talk. And so you could always, you know, you can rely on that. But, I mean, to put on any live event, it's not easy. I think a lot of people who get sucked in, they find it's stressful, it's difficult, it can be expensive, it's often much worse than they ever possibly imagined. And yet they end it and feel exhilarated and they've brought together people. You know, Professor Ramachandran was talking earlier about mirror neurons. When you bring together a group of live people to share an idea, they're all firing off each other. There's something really profound happening. It's kind of the human superorganism at work there. Mm-hmm. And so I can't, you know, the TEDx group in our office, Bonnie, will do their best to help you and give you advice, and there's various guidelines on the site, but we certainly don't promise it's easy.
Good luck to you, Bonnie. Here's another call from Preston, Connecticut. Hi, Gay. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking this call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say I'm a high school teacher, but I teach introduction to speech. And I stumbled upon TED Talks a couple of years ago, and since then, I've used it quite exhaustively in my class for two different primary purposes. One is I love my hidden agenda, which is educating my students on topics such as nutrition, such as going back to the talk in India. There was a fantastic speech on sex trade that had a huge impact on my students. So I get to educate them, but I also get to share with them that a lot of the TED Talk speakers aren't perfect speakers. They can make certain flaws in their delivery that, in a textbook sense, we would point out. But what makes it so powerful for my students is they realize that if you have a passionate core and if your ideas are committed, if you're committed to your ideas, that an audience will embrace you regardless of your flaws. And I think it gives students permission to have confidence
to do the same. Yeah. Gay, thank you. Chris.
I think that's exactly right, that audiences often respond most to the speakers who they think are a little bit nervous or
vulnerable,
you know, vulnerable maybe in some other way, but nonetheless, so long as they're being authentic, right. So long as they are sharing something remarkable, that's all it needs really make an impression.
Let me play a TED Talk from MacArthur Genius and president of an economic consulting group. Majora Carter is her name. She spoke at a TED conference in June 2006 about greening the ghetto.
Environmental justice, for those of you who may not be familiar with the term, goes something like this. No community should be saddled with more environmental burdens and less environmental benefits than any other. Unfortunately, race and class are extremely reliable indicators as to where one might find the good stuff, like parks and trees, and where one might find the bad stuff, like power plants and waste facilities. As a black person in America, I am twice as likely as a white person to live in an area where air pollution poses the greatest risk to my health. I am five times more likely to live within walking distance of a power plant or a chemical facility, which I do. These land use decisions created the hostile conditions that lead to problems like obesity, diabetes, and asthma. Why would someone leave their home to go for a brisk walk in a toxic neighborhood?
It's such a powerful speech, but to your point, Chris, when you watch it, you can see she's a little nervous as she's presenting. Yeah.
Indeed. And you know, although, I mean, you say that's a powerful speech, and it was, but I wonder whether, you know, people listening to just 30 seconds or so of these talks, it's quite possible that someone who's not familiar with TED Talks might go, I don't get it. Because the truth is that you actually can't make that much impression on a talk without the build-up, without the context. And I think that might be one reason why talks of this nature have never really taken off on television, for example. On the web, you get an email from a trusted friend saying, please watch this, trust me. And you watch the first couple sentences, and you might react, possibly as some of you have reacted to some of these things, going, yeah, that's kind of interesting, but in a normal life, I would just turn away. But you stick with it, and by the seventh minute, you're engaged, and by the 13th minute, tears are streaming down your face. And this is the sort of pattern that happens. And I think It's a bit of an enigma. It's actually quite hard to explain to someone in a minute why this stuff really gets inside people's heads. Mm-hmm. So I would encourage, you know, in the rest of that talk, Majora spoke about how she lost her brother. She spoke about how she took her dog on this walk through the Bronx and discovered this broken space, but she had a dream that it could be turned into a park, and she described how the park was built, and it was so beautiful, and everyone at the end stood up and cheered. But you probably wouldn't do that at the end of the 30-second clip.
You know, you have such an interesting background yourself, Chris. You grew up in Afghanistan and Pakistan until you were 13. Your father was a missionary eye surgeon. It's an incredible personal story. You became a successful media entrepreneur. Your company owned more than 100 magazines as well as games websites. I mean, you've done so much. I'm curious, what's the most important thing you have learned from your experience with TED?
Certainly one of the things I learned in the whole transition into TED is that you don't find personal happiness just purely through a business. I was an entrepreneur for a long time and got excited building a company, and it was you know, thrilling, and we went through the whole .com excitement and then the bust. And I actually got quite angry with myself at the time for tying my happiness so much to the growth and success of that business. coming away from that and starting to immerse myself in the world of ideas and reading, and it really reminded me of something that my father had taught me, and which TED speakers have said. Dan Dennett said it. The secret to happiness is to find an idea bigger than you are and devote your life to it. That's what I've learned.
And that's what you're doing. Your vision is extraordinary. To our listeners, the links to all the TED Talks we played today are at our website. Thank you very much for your work and for your vision. Really appreciate it. What a great hour. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you very much, Jane.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.